Busy routines can make it hard to focus on your health goals, but MedExpress offers a simple way to explore weight management treatment online. Complete our short eligibility consultation with no need for face-to-face appointments or travel. If eligible, treatment is delivered discreetly, with UK-registered clinicians offering support along the way. Visit medexpress.co.uk/podcast to get started today.
Have you ever completely overreacted to something and later thought, why did that affect me so much? Sometimes you're not reacting to what's happening now, you're reacting to what happened then. Today, we're talking about how to recognize those patterns, calm the reaction, and choose what happens next. So welcome back to the show, everyone. I want to welcome our very special guest today. His name is Ernest Ellender. He's a life coach and the author of This Is How We Heal from Painful Childhoods. So Ernest helps adults understand how difficult childhood experiences can continue showing up in their confidence, emotions, decisions, and relationships. And today he's giving us something practical we can actually use: his breathe, plan, do formula. So Ernest, welcome back to the show. You were on the show with Stacey in 2024, and we're so excited that you came back to do more shows with us. How's it going? How are you doing?
Quite well, thank you. And thank you for having me back on. Really appreciate it. It's been pretty wild the last 2 years, and it's been fun getting feedback about the book and figuring out what to focus on next. But yeah, appreciate this opportunity.
Well, I'd like to start with something almost everyone can relate to. Something relatively small may happen, but our reaction feels huge. Why does that happen? Like, I don't know, one time I burnt toast and then I freaked out. I started crying and it was just for no reason. It was just the straw that broke the camel's back. Why does that happen?
It sure seems like it's for no reason, because we can't, in our adult brain, often put our finger on what the reason is, but oftentimes there's a very good reason for it. I like to think of the brain, it kind of break the brain into two different components. One's our primal brain. It's like our motor core and our fear sensor, our survival part of our brain. And then there's a really smart part of our brain. It's our prefrontal cortex and the later developed parts of our brain that are really intelligent. And the primal brain is really focused on survival, making sure it's like a friendly bodyguard that keeps us safe. And that friendly bodyguard would be doing a terrible job if it didn't remember these things. Now, when it does come into action to save the day, it routes the blood flow more heavily to that primal brain and kind of shuts down our thinking brain, our smart brain. And so in that moment, we don't think very clearly. Our body just acts. It goes into fight, flight, freeze, or fawn, one of those survival responses. And because there's a shift in blood flow, a lot of times we don't remember those things very well. People who have pretty distinctly traumatic experiences sometimes will have either a hyper-specific memory of it or a super vague memory of it, where they don't even remember it well. But rest assured that the body, that part of the body, that primal brain, has a really strong memory. And sometimes it's just an olfactory memory, like a smell, or sometimes it's a muscular tension in one spot. That part of the brain remembers it, even though the smart part of our brain doesn't quite remember it well. That burning the toast, it might be just an accumulation of stress over the day, or it may be more specific about a parent who is really harsh about you making a mess in the kitchen or something like that, some kind of perfectionistic environment that creates such stress that a child is hypersensitive to, that go into that primal brain dominance, that survival brain takes over, and it reminds you, don't make mistakes, don't do that, don't make mistakes. That's when bad things happen, you know? So that's where a lot of times we can't quite put our finger on it, but it's not for no reason, especially when it's an intensely emotional or fear-based or aggression-based response. Like, there might be something going on there.
Is there a way that we can tell if we're responding to the present versus reacting from a past experience?
Man, yes. And we can certainly enhance that ability to recognize that, you know, by gathering insight and just studying this more and more. You know, initially a lot of people come in and they're not sure why. And it's only through trying to pay attention to the pattern and recognize, wow, it is whenever I make mistakes, or it might be whenever you're cooking, or it might be more specific. So we're looking for these patterns. Well, what keeps triggering you? What keeps doing that? I mean, there's kind of two approaches there. Sometimes we say, we don't know what led to that. We're just going to practice handling it anyway. But more often, it's really nice when you can narrow down and kind of put your finger on what was that instigating thing? What was it? What were those things, those circumstances that led to it? But it's definitely a process. It's usually a process. It's usually not super obvious right away. But it's usually a bit of a process of observing yourself, practicing, staying more calm so you can tolerate it more, and looking back at these and recognizing pattern. And oftentimes it's exploring it with somebody, with a therapist or coach or something like that. Some professional who helps you through that process of gaining more personal insight and more that cognitive skill of recognizing it and going into action. So yeah, it's not always easy, but there's a process, but we definitely can learn how to recognize those things, be more aware when they're coming up, when we know we're going to be in those circumstances, or when it does trigger, we can very much practice and get very good at not responding to it. That's part of that. But this tool I wanted to share today, that's kind of like a meta skill of practicing that. This is kind of how do you practice that?
Yeah, I think a lot of people don't realize how much their childhood affects them today. Like, I grew up in an environment where, school was really important to my parents, and working really hard was really important to my parents, and like working really, really hard. So I always felt like whatever I did in life, I wouldn't be able to, be successful unless I was working 12 hours a day and like exhausted, and then that would be what the definition of success was. And so
yes,
until I realized that, whoa, this is like an old pattern that I'm living, that my family kind of brought me up to be like, then I started to realize that that didn't have to be the way that I was living. But a lot of people do things and react to life based on that, but don't even realize it. It's very interesting how those moments, like even one thing from when we're 5 years old, can completely alter our life at 40 or 50.
It's been constantly, continuously fascinating to me, year after year, recognizing the so many ways that it does, all the way from our very genetic inheritance to daily habits. I'm really curious, for example, how many hours a week do you work now?
A lot less.
A lot less. Okay. When did you start that process of, was that a targeted decision to reduce those number of hours that you work on a weekly basis?
It was a mindset shift in that, well, I burnt out after working in a job that I was working crazy hours. So it was like the universe made me slow down. And while I was slowing down, I got a few mentors that we talked about like what success looks like and how I can manage that in a better way, and to learning to sit with myself. So it was a long process. I'm guessing it probably took about 10 years. And I still have moments where I feel kind of guilty for sitting on the couch. But it's so much better.
Yes. And there's two components to that story that are really intriguing to me. One is, when we talk about how childhood affects us. Yeah, I like the cognitive behavioral model. The cognitive behavioral model is where we break our human functioning into cognitive, behavioral, and emotional components. Those three. Cognitive is our thinking stuff. Behavioral is physical world, and emotional is how we're feeling. And that triangle, those three things are remarkably stable. There's a fear of the unknown. So whatever is the known, even if it's not fun, it's known, and the body doesn't want to change it. The primal brain doesn't want to change it. It's very stable. So those behaviors of working large numbers of hours is a habit of the family that's handed down to the next generation and the next generation, unless there's just tremendous rejection of it for whatever reason. There's those habits. Then there's these cognitive habits or image that's handed down that, success equals long hours and hard work. That's what success means. That's what work ethic is, working long hours to exhaust. And then emotionally, that emotion of intensity, almost like adrenaline-based intensity until exhaustion. And those are they're remarkably stable. And so when you say it took a 10-year process, yeah, and that's with guidance and with seeking professional assistance and hearing them and interacting with that and putting thought into it. And that's where I like to make sure people, when they're new to it, understand it as a process and a lifestyle. Unlike a lot of in the movies where we see they go in and there's this one session in which they just understand suddenly and therapeutically they heal from that. Oh, my parents were perfectionist and they drove me and nothing was ever good enough. Now I can shed that and I can love myself whether I'm perfect or not. It's wonderful if that little bit of insight would do the trick and you would be healed and you could just pick a new way to live. But you have cognitive images. You have that cognitive understanding of the world that has to really spend time shifting. You have all these physical habits. And then to change that into this other emotional state of living in adrenaline-based anxiety and then exhaustion, shifting that into what now would you say on your best, on your good day, on your great days when you've done, say you worked 30 hours that week, but you feel accomplished from that week. What emotions come up for you there? What are the good emotions? What emotion is that for you?
I think I'm like pretty good at it now. I just feel better. Like I just feel more at peace and at rest. So without, you know, running around, but it's like I'm recognizing it. So you're right. Like at first, when I first started working on these behaviors and feeling good enough, it didn't feel good. Like it felt awful. So sitting still for 5 minutes was hard. Sitting still for 2 minutes was hard. Taking a day off was hard, you know, taking a day off and then still not being able to sleep in because there's this like mental aspect of like, no, you should be doing something. So it took a long time. But now I'm just like at total peace with it, which is really nice. But there are moments still that you get pulled back into it, I find. So I will do really, really, really well for a while. And then all of a sudden I have like a day or two of feeling like, oh, am I doing enough? So it creeps back in, even though I've been working on it for so long.
Absolutely. Sometimes I think of the cognitive realm as like a brainwashing in childhood. And most of that, hopefully a lot of that brainwashing is very good. Love yourself, respect others, et cetera, things like that. But some of that brainwashing is less helpful or even damaging, you know, and there. See, I heard a little should statement there. Should, what should we be doing? Should be working. What should you be doing? Oh, you should be working. If you're not working, you're lazy or you're a failure. You're not doing what you should be doing. So there's, and sometimes when we get exhausted or a different phase of life or something comes up, there are many reasons why that the stability of that childhood, maybe less helpful brainwashing, resurfaces. It's just remarkably stable. So, and it goes back to, so we got to learn how to correct those thoughts and then learn how to maintain them and learn how to keep progressing them. And that's in connection with the physical behaviors and the emotions. It's wonderful. I'm glad to hear that most of the time now it sounds like you've made that wonderful shift of being acclimated to, and just your normal was anxiety based, adrenaline based, run around followed by exhaustion, to one where after a week that you've been productive and you've done a job at work and you can actually sit in calm and rest and tranquility. It was hard fought for, huh?
It was hard fought for sure. And I think a lot of people mistake their actions for being who they are. So they don't really know, like, are their actions coming from past or like conditioning, or is that actually their personality? So people sometimes just assume that they're an overthinker or, you know, a people pleaser, but really they're not. Like, I don't know. It's not who they are. So there are those people, and it'd be interesting to see how they would react if they knew that they could change that.
Yes, yes. And then, so I'm a big fan of, I'm a martial artist. And so that's where all through my studying and clinical psychology and then life coaching, I the whole time I was training a lot of martial arts. So when I look at, I think of a lot of things in martial arts terms and as that metaphor. And so when we have this goal, we want to change, I want to be able to do this thing. You know, we can kind of understand it, but then there's a massive issue of how do I get there? How do I develop these skills? And then we have to maintain those skills to be able to effectively do what we wanted to do. Okay, I don't want to live like this frantic all the time and just an exhaustion and burnout. I can identify with your story.
Mm-hmm.
Family of highly academic professionals. And boy, there's a lot of perfectionism and there's a lot of high anxiety involved in that. And studying this stuff, it took me many years to even recognize. I didn't understand that it was that we were a high stress family. It was just normal to mm-hmm. me. But as I was practicing, I used to hate doing controlled breathing, muscle relaxation. It was so boring to me in school. And then when I started having to practice that with my clients, the first year where I had my own clients and working with them over an entire year, and we had to keep practicing the controlled breathing, muscle relaxation to develop that skill. Like you said in the beginning, it feels like I'm torturing somebody sometimes when I come in and I see they're just a super anxious person, a high trauma-based person. Oftentimes, it feels like I'm torturing them to get them to sit still and relax for 2 minutes.
Sure.
And then the next session, we go for 3 minutes. And then the next session a week later, we're going for 5 minutes. It's a very physical skill in that behavioral realm that takes time and practice to develop. So that momentary insight, oh, okay, my family's perfectionist, nothing was ever good enough. And okay, great. That's really wonderful cognitive insight. But now how do you relax? How do you actually do it? Sit there, breathe deeply. There's a whole, have you done what kind of breath work or, you know, self-calming, self-care kind of practice have you done out of curiosity?
What kind of breath work? So I'm a regular at the yoga studio. So I typically go to yoga every single day. But I'm into the holotropic breath work. So I'm into like the intense breath work where you go on like a journey, essentially, because yes. When I do that, I'm able to actually see situations come up like a movie film in my mind of like past things and let them go. I'm a big fan of box breathing of like the four in and four out. So I've really used a lot of tools. I would say I've got a backpack of tools that I can use. I also learned that humming can help with getting me out of the sympathetic nervous system mode into parasympathetic. So I use that sometimes if I'm stressed out. But it came down to me realizing that I didn't feel safe in my body. And so I remember being in my 20s and 30s and I was addicted to drugs and I'm going to these jobs and I was so irritated all the time. And I would be like, I was so miserable and I was so irritated. And it was so interesting to me because I was able to separate it. And I knew that wasn't the way I was going to be forever and that I wanted to live my life differently, but I didn't know why and I didn't know how. And so that's where that kind of triggered like all the self-help stuff. I don't know. I'm just kind of addicted to it, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. And I love this is what a wonderful example of, I do not believe there's any one thing there. So you just named what, three or four different approaches to breath work. He has started with just the most basic, box breathing, very specifically just to get out of from sympathetic, from survival response into parasympathetic, now that rest and digest, to reroute that blood flow so it can think more clearly. And I like that just very straightforward thing because, again, like I said in the beginning, I thought it was so boring. I couldn't plan. But then I realized after doing it with clients for a while, I would feel much more calm after session. I'm like, oh, okay, I have an anxiety issue I wasn't quite aware of. And I had all these high expectations of self. And yeah, okay, so I was learning a lot from my own clients and whatnot. But after doing it a few years, I was thinking, oh, I'm getting pretty good at this breathing stuff. And then I was introduced to free diving where you hold your breath underwater. And I met this guy and it was like, he just doing 7 or 8 minute breath holds, blew my mind. And then I realized that rabbit hole is so deep as far as what human breath work can do. There are just so many wonderful, exciting ways, some that amp you up, some that sharpen your focus, some that calm us down. And I'm working on breaking just the 4 minute barrier. I got 3 minutes and 57 seconds. So I'm so close to breaking 4 minute breath hold. And so now it's fun. And so I like to try to make it as fun as possible. Like in our jiu-jitsu training, our martial arts training, if it's not fun, we're not going to come back to it. So if every session is a brutal session of diving into trauma stuff, it's just, it's too brutal. The burnout is too great. So when we make it fun, like going to yoga every day, that you must not force yourself to go. You must gain things out of it. Yeah, it becomes a thing that is soothing of itself. It's attractive. Huh? So the sooner we can get to that point, great. But at first, it's challenging, right? Sometimes we force ourselves to get it. But yeah. So I sent you the tool, that Breathe, Plan, Do formula, right? Upon initially looking at the tool, most of the time people say, well, especially somebody brand new, it says, well, obviously, of course, it's so simple. Of course, I'm already breathing. I'm alive, and therefore I'm breathing. What's the next step? So I like to share that martial arts concept of on day one, somebody showed me, call our Jiu-Jitsu 101. Here's the 101 basics. And on day one, by the end of that one class, I understood the concept. I'm in this position, and I want to get to this position, and this is the goal. So I understood it in my mind. And I could run through the technique, but as soon as we started to get amped up, as soon as I went to try to do it to somebody who was not going to let me do it, I was completely incompetent and could not do it. And so there's a massive difference between an amateur just first time looking at it and becoming really advanced in it.
Yes.
So, I mean, imagine the first week that you try that breathing stuff compared to now.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I would imagine you're approaching professional level, if not at least advanced intermediate level of breathing expert, would you say?
Absolutely. It took a long time. I mean, it started with meditation and meditation just like for a couple minutes at a time. But it became my next addiction, I guess, is like when you feel peace, even for a second, it's like you realize that it is possible to feel that way versus feeling like you're always being chased by a tiger. So, yeah, I mean, it took a long time. And I think the box breathing, like as a starter for people out there, if they're stressed out, if they're driving right now and listening to this and they've had a stressful day, just to try it, like breathe in for 4 seconds and breathe out. We often forget how powerful we are in that way. But it definitely did take a while. And I think I'm up to a 3 minute and 40 second breath hold now. So, yeah, it's super fun.
Yes. Super fun. I love to hear that. So when we're new to this, I like to throw in a couple of rules, a couple of little pointers in there that help us comprehend the importance of it. If the next phase is plan, and in planning, we want to use the best part of our brain, the most intelligent and creative part of our brain.
And so if breathe is the first step. Breathe, plan is the second
step. Plan is the second step, and then do. We got to do something, do anything to move us towards our goal. Because if I don't do something, that's kind of the easiest part, actually, because if I just have to do anything to move me in that direction. If I don't do it, then I don't experience the progress and I don't experience that confidence building because I know I'm just kind of avoiding it. But if I do something over time, I recognize I become more and more practiced at building personal confidence, right? The do part is kind of the easiest part of it, actually. It's the planning that's kind of the more challenging, the most challenging, I think, takes the longest. It takes a lot of insight, a lot of work is done in that planning phase. And if I'm in a survival response, like you said, people are driving home from work right now, they might still be amped up from work. And if they're still amped up, they're in 40% survival mode. Somebody with a strong trauma history might be in 80% survival mode, 70%. That means, just for simplicity's sake, I like to just suggest that means you have 30% positive blood flow to the smart part of your brain. So do our box breathing. We do 10 of those box breathings in a row. The first two, we kind of rush through, and then the third, and the fourth, and the fifth, and then the sixth, and then the seventh. By the time you've done 10 of those, you might get from that 70% survival mode down to 20%. Now you have 80% good blood flow to a creative part of our brain. So our success in the planning phase is very dependent on our skill in that first phase and that first step of breathe. It's not just breathe, it's breathe, until we have achieved the maximum amount of parasympathetic of our rest and digest mode as we are possible at this time. So breathe until then. When we're doing that, the breathing, the box breathing, is the physical component. That's in that behavioral phase, the physical component. It very much helps to have a few cognitive components, a few thinking-based things that help with, that accentuate that. Because I can sit there and do my deep breathing, but if I'm looking at a pit bull running at me, I'm aware, I'm thinking I am about to die. Uh-huh. But I'm trying to do this breathing, but my thinking is telling me I'm about to die, right? So I want to have some thinking that assists me with this deeper relaxation, the activation of our calm. And I need to feel safe. So while driving home, practicing the square breathing, we can start with a thought. This is not a life-threatening situation. This is not life-threatening. If I'm trying to have a conversation with my significant other and I'm triggered, I'm feeling emotional and I'm getting defensive and I feel my tension in my body, say I need to do a few deep box breaths and remind myself this conversation is not a life-threatening situation. Inhale deep into the diaphragm. 1, 2, 3, 4. Exhale. This is not a life-threatening situation. This is not life-threatening. I cannot die from this conversation. So that starts to teach the primal brain, okay, you're not needed right now. This is actually not a life-threatening scenario, so you can calm down. For people with a lot of trauma history in their childhood, there can be a high degree of constant anxiety, fear-based, and that strong danger messaging. Seems like there's danger everywhere. That can be very challenging. And so there's often another one there where we have some recommendations there where I can acknowledge that it's extra difficult for my primal brain to calm down because of my trauma history, because of my childhood. So it's not life-threatening. And I know that my primal brain is perceiving some of these things to be dangerous when they're really not dangerous. My primal brain is perceiving this to be dangerous because of these, we call them like trauma lies, the childhood brain came up with, and they're running in the background in the subconscious. If I'm not working hard enough, then I'm a failure. If I'm not producing, then I'm lazy. Those kinds of trauma lies that are right under the surface. And once we surface them and we can see it, now we can add that to that breathe part. It's not life-threatening. It's okay to calm down. I'm feeling extra anxious because of this trauma lie that's telling me I'm a failure if I'm not kicking butt today and doing working all this. I can get to a deeper relaxation, I'm truly safe right now. And I want to plan. So let me get to that super calm spot. So there's a bit of work there, both physically and cognitively, to really develop that breathe plan for each individual.
Mm-hmm.
For the plan phase. And in the plan phase is where we do the initial simple concept is we want to shift from survivalistic, reactive thinking and behaviors. We want to shift away from reactive survival thinking into goal-oriented, principled or values-driven thinking and goal, thinking and behaviors. So in the planning phase, I can recognize this is what my body wants to automatically do. And I don't want to react to that. And I don't want to just follow my habits and what I've automatically, reactively, instinctively kind of do. I want to do something different. What are the goals here? So with your example, you wanted to not be in that burnout mode. You wanted to did you have a clear picture of what that thriving picture would look like? What would it look like to be successful and not burned out? What was that thriving image for you was there a well-defined image there of success for you?
It changed. I recall at first it was like more in my 30s, I'd say more material things like having house, car, family, whatever, vacations. But then now in my 40s, my vision board is more like peace and energy and helping and being of service. So it changed over the years. So success to me now is like being able to put my head on my pillow and knowing that I did what I said I was going to do and just helping people, I guess, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. So in that planning phase, you have this particular instance. I can either do an extra 4 hours today or, that's the reactive, want to go back to the old things and hit that 11, 12-hour workday. and say, well, that's my reactive automated thing. That's plan number one. Action plan number two is, how would a thriving person that you want to be, someone who is, I heard, energetic, helpful to others, like of service, like servicing, like wanting to produce healing things for people, and energetic. So if I run an extra 3 or 4 hours burnout, that's not going to be energetic. It might help some people more today, but then I burn out and I won't be able to help them for the next 10 years. So over time, maintaining a high degree of energy means you need more sleep and you need to wake up with more energy and not be exhausted all the time. So energetic, helpful towards others, wonderful, and productive. So what would somebody who is thriving that way, what would that behavioral game plan look like? And so we can have one option that is the old reactive way, kind of easy to imagine because it wants to automatically happen. And then what is a new way? And sometimes we come up with two. There might be option one, new way, and option two, new way. And then we're thinking through, trying to imagine how that would play out. So the more clear we have, the more clear picture we have of that goal. So in your 30s, it was driven towards, you know, those kind of securities and those things that make you feel successful. And then that thriving image shifted. The more we have that clear image of it, the more precise this can be. And that's is very normal for that to change, right? It changes yearly. It changes annually, typically. We want this tool to be something that just assists with making whatever that process is more efficient. So I calm down more efficiently to that as close to 100% parasympathetic, where I can think more clearly. And then in the plan phase, the more precise that image is, of slow down and think about what do I really want to look like? Who's my hero? What do I want to look like? Do I want to look like that person who's all worn out and exhausted? Or do I want to look like that person who invented something that helped so many people and they're just kind of chill and successful and enjoying life? That one looks more energetic. And then what does that look like in today? Like, so the behavioral game plan is what comes next. So in the next few minutes or the next hour or the next day, what am I going to do? What's the specific game plan to execute that thriving image? And I would try to break that into something. I just have to do one thing. I don't have to do the whole thing. That might be a long process. I just need to figure out one thing. That one thing might be, okay, I'll do 10 more minutes and then that's it for the day. I'm done. Or it might be, no, I'm already done. That thriving image, I've done for the day, period. Time to stop thinking about work and start thinking about playing or relaxing. Self-care, what have you. So do at least one step of that, one little part. So initially, this breathe, plan, do formula, it seems so super simple until we slow down and look at each part of it. Having just a tremendous amount of macro and micro skills to get really good at each step of it.
The misconception, especially nowadays with social media and all these quick fixes, is that there really is no super quick fix. We all want to heal really quickly, but the truth is that it does take a long time.
Yes. I love the instant insights that we get to understand, oh, that came from my parents, or, oh, that's great insight. But especially when we have childhood family dysfunction, there's often a lot of just micro and macro skills that are in deficit. I think running a healthy, stable business, and in any healthy, stable business, everybody has these different skills that they contribute, you know, being on time or being holding, you know, contributing different ways, and all these micro, macro skills, conflict resolution, planning, all these skills. And when we're raised in a dysfunctional, unhealthy environment, we're lacking in a bunch of skills. So the insight is instant. Oh, I was raised in a very unhealthy environment. And I can forgive my parents and or what have you. I can get past the rejection I can heal from and let go of anger. But what about this conflict resolution skill deficit? When I get in an argument with my significant other, I'm just used to people yelling at each other and then refusing to talk about it for a few days and then not addressing it again. Well, there's an actual process. Maybe next episode, we could discuss a communication cheat sheet where's this cheat sheet that offers us step by step so we can make up for that skills deficit. And skills just take time to develop. They take focused, practice over time, and then we develop it, and then it feels much easier later on. Feels easier,
absolutely.
Even though it's still challenging, but it feels much easier because now we have the skill. So yeah, there's no magic bullet that just heals it.
No,
and I wish it was awesome, like in the movies, like that one session that just clicks and like I am healed from my childhood.
Well, no. There are those moments throughout the journey, though. That's what got me hooked. Is like after a while, you reach that light bulb moment, and then you're like, oh, okay, this makes sense now. And then you travel a little bit further, and then you get another one of those moments, and then they start adding up, and it becomes a journey. And then you realize that it's just your life, right? Like,
yes,
your work is your life. So being able to understand yourself at a deep level, I don't know. I feel like that's the most important work that we can do in this lifetime. So it's pretty cool, work. Ernest, why don't you tell people where you got this passion from and talk more about your book and your coaching?
Yeah, where did the passion come from? And my parents are just, very community oriented people. They're very just kind of generous, hardworking people. So I think I kind of took after that aspect of it. And so I was naturally drawn toward the like therapy realm. I got into psychology, and that was really fun, engaging directly with people. Just being of service to people, and it's just kind of addictive, you know. And we're very academic, so I went all the way to PhD in clinical psychology. And I am a kind of OCD, and very obsessive about stuff. And so my brain's kind of attracted to very challenging things. So when we got into childhood trauma and like complex PTSD, it was just naturally very fascinating to me. It's very complex. I think named complex PTSD very appropriately. It's very complex. It's very challenging. And so it was in that pursuit that I was looking for, you know, like a full holistic curriculum for what's going on in one family unit where it can be so awful without outside intervention. Like how's it possible? And that's what, again, paired with my martial arts training and whatnot, is this, how do we address all that? The book is structured so that I was looking for this laundry list. Like, what are the laundry list things that we need to address? Like conflict resolution is one of those things. Like there's this manipulation or aggression, all these, how do we interact with one another? How do we control or interact with one another? Well, if you're only accustomed to people trying to control you in a negative fashion, we have to have, when we remove that, we have to have something to replace it. So we need an answer for this one variable of interacting with one another. And so after all the studying and dialing it in, I came up with a curriculum of 20 different variables. I wish it was less, so it'd be more simple, but it's not, you know. A lot of books sell better when they have, you know, the 5 or 7, whatever, you know, those magic numbers, 3, 5, 7 that sell better. But sorry, there was 20 critical variables. And we just want to have an answer for each one of those. We want to understand the concept and have a process for addressing each of those 20. Addiction, overindulgent dynamics, bad control, switching out for good control, being able to shift from sympathetic to parasympathetic. You know, each one of these is critical. If we don't have it, the other ones don't, it doesn't fully address that picture. So that's what my book is based on. That's what it focuses on. And I was doing a psychology thing. And then I about 5 or 6 years ago during COVID, I shifted to coaching and more specifically trauma-informed mentor coaching, to be very precise. So therapy is often a lot more focused on the past and on mental health symptoms. But my martial arts training, I like focusing on the skills development part of it. So that's more the mentor part, where a mentor is somebody who understands a certain skill set that I want. So I want that person to mentor me on how to develop that skill set. So that's the mentor part. The trauma-informed is an awareness of that subject matter. So a pure life coach is not a subject matter expert. They're like a thinking partner that helps you think through things and helps you develop a game plan that you know is going to be best. A trauma-informed life coach is one who has studied trauma, so they understand there are some unique things we need to understand. A lot of it's complex and counterintuitive. So if you have a strong trauma history, it's probably best to find someone who is trauma-informed. There are some unique pitfalls there, some counterintuitive things there. So there's the trauma-informed mentor coach. That's kind of my specific niche. I love working with people who are ambitious. They want to improve their relationships, or they want to achieve more stability in their life, more calm and peace, more tranquility, the ability to connect with people, to argue less with loved ones, to be able to recognize a safe person versus an unsafe person. Those kinds of skills. That's who I love working with. And I do, amazing, you know, online and in person coaching. I also love working with, I've started more recently and love working with therapists and coaches who want to do more of this. Because like you, I love being productive. So the idea of helping somebody who's excited about it develop more understanding and competency in working with it has a magnifying effect. So I get to help one person who then turns around and helps hundreds and hundreds. Well, that's really fun. That's really fun for me. So I love working with, you know, students and other life coaches and other therapists and psychologists who want to advance their comfort and competency in working with trauma clients. So that's what I love doing. Yeah.
Where can people find more information about you?
Healfromchildhood.com. That's my website. I'm reworking my other one, ErnestEllinerPhD.com. So, but it's just go to healfromchildhood.com, and it kind of focuses on my book. I'll be revamping it, but that's where you can contact me there. You can read more about the book, and there's even a 36-page free summary of my book. I don't want price to be a problem for people to at least be able to be introduced to these concepts. So there's a 36-page free summary of it. So you can at least begin that process of understanding each of those 20 variables. So all that's available on healfromchildhood.com.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show today and sharing your expertise with people and talking a little bit about your past and diving into mine a little bit. If someone listening is interested in, you know, getting started in healing today, what advice would you tell them?
Man, pick a place and get started. You know, wherever you're comfortable. I think so, a lot of times in the beginning, if it's possible, it's nice to be able to get professional advice from the beginning, because a lot of times that makes sure you're on the right path right away, if that's possible. If not, you know, there's so much free resources out there. It's wonderful. Like you called it, like when you said you shifted from trying to do this one or two things into it as a journey, start the journey. Just start the journey. If that's with a professional, great. If it's with just reading something that feels safer to you, listening to podcasts like this, infusing our mind with this, you know, different stories and different guidance from professionals, wonderful. But start that journey and just keep on it. It becomes really fun, even if it's born of pain and struggle in the beginning. It becomes really addictive and at least gratifying. Soothing and gratifying. Absolutely. Over time. Get started and stick with it. Yeah. Get started and stick with it.
Amazing. So thank you so much for being here, like I said, and I look forward to the next time.
Thank you so much, Lisa. Thank you so much. Much appreciated.
And I want to reach out and say thank you to our audience for tuning in to the show today. I think the biggest takeaway from today is quite simple. Our past may explain our reactions, but we don't have to keep choosing those responses. So remember, breathe, plan, and do. If this conversation made you recognize something in yourself, please visit healfromchildhood.com to learn more about Ernest's work and his coaching, and check out his book, This is How We Heal from Painful Childhoods, a practical guide for healing past intergenerational stress and trauma, which we'll have linked in the show notes for you as well. And make sure you come back and join us for the next episode, because we're taking everything we talked about today and we're bringing it into the place where those patterns often show up the most. in relationships. So thanks again for tuning in, everyone. Until next time, take care and have a great weekend. Bye-bye.